Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you, Sal?
Outstanding. Well, we have a guest joining us remotely. He's a returning guest, one of our favorites, Josh Linville. How are you doing, Josh?
I'm doing good. Just got a few days until Christmas Eve when I start shopping for my wife.
Absolutely. There's no. You do not want to get started too early. We'll pull your man card.
I was going to say, absolutely. Yeah, as she knows.
Yeah, all the best sales are at Tractor Supply on Christmas Eve day.
That's what she's always wanted.
Well, before we get started, Josh, it is time for the question of the day. And I got a feeling you'll like this one. What vehicle or machinery, motorcycle have you had that you wish you had back? So think back, like, did you have something that one of those things that, boy, I wish I had that back today?
Can I have two?
Sure you can.
So first one I'd have to have, and it's a 1980 Honda Prelude. Silver, red nasty interior. It had a Spark-O-Matic radio. First car I ever had. Actually, my dad bought it off my grandpa because my uncle was driving it. I love that freaking car. It's a pile of junk, stick shift, but I love that thing to death. I've still been looking for one. If one pops up on eBay, they are going to be able to fleece me with the price because I'll pay whatever I have to get my hands on this car.
Well, that one's probably still running. Those things were indestructible.
Well, I wouldn't say indestructible. My sister got it after I did. So you notice I'm still looking for a car.
Destructible.
You want one, just not that particular one.
Yes. That particular one was a little destructible.
Oh no.
But the second one, I had a 2002 Chevy Silverado pickup.
It was legendary. Legendary in the Tampa area.
Oh, so the trusty rusty. Taking a pickup truck that's been driven all over the Midwest with all the salt and everything like that. And this thing was in bad shape when we lived in Kansas City and Wichita. I mean, literally at the time I worked at Coke, I kept waiting for the day that somebody's going to come out and say, Mr. Linville, you can't drive this on our parking lot anymore. So we took this thing to Florida. And we lived there for a short time. We knew we were going to come back to Kansas City. So we spent a little bit of life savings. We stayed at a very nice place, very near the water. And our house was nowhere near this knife, but the ones that we were across from backed up to the water. So you're talking some very high dollar vehicles. I would park this piece of junk in the driveway. And for some reason, our neighbors wouldn't talk to me. They had these. I've got a picture, this mobile detailer with the trailer, and he's got this beautiful, it's like a Mercedes or something like that, and they're working on it. And I've got the picture of all that in the background, and I've got my truck where literally you can go up and touch it, just rust and dirt just falls off of it.
If you can find that picture, Josh, we'll put that up. That'll be awesome.
I actually catch it on Facebook. Like, I can't imagine why my neighbors won't talk to me.
What happened to old trusty Rusty?
So we moved back, and we had ended up buying a house just down the street from another place because we had rented our original house out and they had moved out. So moving our stuff. The last load of stuff, I am pulling out of the driveway to take it over, and it drops to low four-wheel drive. Will not switch back. And I'm just like, this is it. This thing isn't even worth scrap. So we limp it along over the other driveway. We unload it. We all do the things. I was exhausted. And I told Angela, okay, I'm going to go in. I'm going to list it. I'm going to see if I can't just find somebody to come pick it up for scrap, for like $300. Well, next morning, I wake up and I'm sitting there out in the driveway and stuff working and everything. And an old neighbor swings by and I'm out in the driveway talking to him. He's like, oh, so you sold your truck already? And I turned around. I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I did. Cool. And I go back inside. I said, okay, I'd gone a bit early the night before. I said, so I guess you got the thing sold last night. She's like, what are you talking about? I was like, the pickup, you sold it. She's like, Josh, I didn't sell it. Turns out it had been stolen overnight.
No.
I had actually let the keys in it. And every once in a while, you have groups that come up from Inner Kid City and they'll encase the neighborhood and do stuff like that. And they saw the keys, they took off. So these morons took a rusted out piece of junk truck that was almost 20 years old in four wheel low and drove until I just said, screw it, we're done with this. So they made a grand getaway at like 35 mile an hour.
You should have kept full insurance on that thing and
just screaming.
Oh my gosh.
That's the high crime rate of Platte, Missouri.
Yep.
That's where it was stolen. Was in Missouri.
Yeah.
Oh,
just
north
of Kansas City. But yeah, it was that sucker boy. You knew it was my pickup. And it was one of those things where you kind of go through the curve. You're proud of it. Ooh, it's deteriorating. It doesn't look good. And it hits that point where it's like, man, this thing is so crappy. I never like it. And I like it more. And now all of a sudden it's a status symbol. I still got this junk truck.
Badge of courage. Driving down the highway with that.
Josh would park that thing in the parking garage when we worked together. And, you know, it's, you know, everybody's got the, you know, the Audis and the Beamers and stuff. And then here comes Josh and Trusty Rusty. It was awesome. Everybody remembers Trusty Rusty. They don't remember the BMWs that everybody else had. And it was awesome.
You can take the kid out of the country.
That's right.
I bet people got out of your way in the parking garage though, driving that.
Oh yeah.
You hit one of the Beamers. Yeah. Oh, that'll buff right out. It'll be fine. I'm good if you're good.
Yeah. I'm perfectly okay. It'll go well with the other bumps and dings in it.
That's good.
Jeff, top Trusty Rusty. I don't know if you can do that.
I can't do that. I did see you put motorcycle on the list.
I did.
So when I was a kid, I had a Honda Trail 70, and I wish I had that thing back. That would be really cool.
How old were you?
I think I was probably, nine or 10 years old when I got that. And just ran the wheels off of it and, you know, jump stuff. Got hauled to the emergency room a couple times, you know, that kind
of
stuff.
No helmet, of course.
But when my kids were little, I started looking in to see if you could find one of those old Trail 70s. And it's like, you know, I probably bought it for $300. Yeah. They're like $2,000 plus now. They're like a collector's item.
No way.
The old Honda Trail 70. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Wish I had it back, but I don't.
It's funny you say that. I had a... this wasn't on my list, but it's a Honda 100. And I went everywhere on that motorcycle. As soon as mom and dad were gone, I was gone. I was up the road running to Campbellsburg. And
county sheriffs would stop and chew you out until you get home. And
yep, good times. I was fifth or sixth grade, and off I'd go.
That's right.
Yep. I think mine would have been, I had a Jeep CJ5. When I was in high school and joined the Marines, and my buddy ended up with a Jeep, and that was it. Of course I was traveling after that. But if I could roll back the clock, I'd have that old Jeep back. I'd have to had the distributor cap every time it rained. I'd have to have paper towels in the Jeep and I'd have to dry out the inside of the distributor cap. And it would die. And I'd be like, no problem. I'd go get my paper towels and dry it out, put it back on, and off I'd go again.
I don't know if kids can work on vehicles today like we used to have to.
I don't think they could. No.
Yeah.
I had one that it would always die. You'd have to push start it. And the battery's always
you'd park
dead.
It on a hill.
Yeah. Have a couple buddies with you. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So the good old days.
You need a laptop to do anything to it. You can do it if you needed to.
Well, Jeff, I'm going to let you and Josh talk about fertilizer markets. You just got anhydrous pricing, I think,
anhydrous prepay for spring came out yesterday. And, so we're frantically trying to get some prices out to the countryside. It's the middle of December. We'll try to get this podcast released pretty early so we can get some fertilizer information out to our viewers. But, Josh, you want to give us an update? We mentioned anhydrous. Let's just start with the nitrogen market and what you're seeing there.
Yeah. So, the focus, obviously, like you're saying, is on anhydrous, but for me, anhydrous is almost a reactionary situation to the urea market. Because again, when you look globally, what's the most traded nitrogen product that's out there?
Urea.
Yeah.
Urea. So that sets the tone. I would consider that to be the most commodity-like nitrogen product that's in the world. And so because it's commodity-like, it follows the cycles, it follows the path of emotion, everything like that. So that's, I think, personally speaking, I'm not saying I'm right. It's just when I look at the marketplace, I like to look at stuff like that because that really sets the tone for the other products like UAN and like anhydrous. Hmm. So a lot of people are probably looking at all their nitrogen saying, this is ridiculous. This is sky high. And we get it. I fully understand where you're coming from. I'm not here to sit there and tell you it's cheap by any means. But you've got to look at the situation of the world. And when you look at urea, China, they're typically, historically speaking, about 10% of the global export market. They export around 5.5 million ton of a 50, 55 million ton global marketplace.
Of urea.
And they just haven't exported this year. When you look at their total January through October, 257,000 tons. Not 2.5, not 5, 257,000 tons.
Big drop.
Is that because of their increasing corn acres? I mean, I've always heard that China's are they keeping it more, obviously, domestically?
So what we continue to see is that their production rates have remained high, which lends the question of, like, where in the world is this stuff going? If their production rates are up here, presuming you trust those numbers, it's China. You know, take it with the, you know. But let's assume that that's correct. And they are still producing the tons. Or are they going with it? And we don't truly know, right? It's China. It's very hard to get true stories out of there. But the story I have adhered to the most, because I think it checks a lot of the boxes, is that they're using more. And what have we seen out of the Chinese central government, Chinese communist government? We want to be self-sufficient. We don't want to buy these grains from Western countries. We don't like those guys. We don't want to support them. We want to do them ourselves. And let's make sure we remember, we're listening to this in the middle of some of the best farm ground in the world with some of the best technology for applying and fertilizers and things like that. So we can dial that sucker down to a pound per acre, right? In China, what do you see pictures of? A farmer with a bag and he's throwing it out in the field. So if the government comes in as a communist country, comes in and says, you need to raise more bushels. You need to put more fertilizer on it. Okay, give me a couple more bags. I'll toss it out in the field. That honestly, and you think about it, it's like, okay, well, that's 5 million tons. That's a lot of tons. It's all of a sudden use more of. Think about the size of the country. Yes, it's a decent jump higher. But again, when you're just throwing the stuff out of a bag, it's not that out of line.
What if they get too much on? Are they worried about their environmental laws?
You know, there's the talking points and the actuality.
It just never comes up.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. farmer, you know, sometimes I think they get sick of hearing, oh, it's a global market. It's a global market. But it truly is. And that's, you know, trying to get that message across to them. Do you have a good way to talk about the message of how that global market impacts them?
Yeah. A lot of people sit there and say, and we've really seen this recently as the Trump administration comes in, they're talking about tariffs and all this stuff. And people are like, we don't care. We'll just use our own. We don't have enough. When you look at this year, we think that we need to import about 5.1, 5.2 million tons of urea to meet our demand in the spring. We do not have enough nitrogen production based in North America to meet our demand. About half of our imports of urea comes from the Middle East. Why do I spend so much time waking up every single morning and checking the news sites to see if they're Israel and Iran have gotten into it, or Israel and anybody else around them have gotten into it? Because half our tons come from that part of the world. And if all of a sudden they start to shut down, we're going to be battling with everybody else in the world trying to get fewer tons.
Yeah, this is one of the things that Josh brought to realization for me was, because, you know, we talk about the war in Israel and stuff. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, well, hey, Israel, that's not a big nitrogen producing country. I don't know if they produce any. There's this little thing called the Suez Canal, and it's about 100 miles from Israel. And if I'm a ship owner, I really don't want to get my ship real close to a war zone because there's these guys out there that just lob a little mortar and blow your ship out of the water. So that adds cost and sailing time. And can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's you know, we actually saw that. If you remember months ago, there's actually a vessel that was hit by a missile as it traveled through the Red Sea. Guess what that vessel had on it?
Urea.
That's fertilizer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Coming from Saudi Arabia, right? That thing now sits at the bottom of that ocean. And yeah, to your point, if you're a ship owner, am I going to put my multi-million dollar asset through a war zone? Am I going to put my crew in danger? Am I going to pay the increased insurance rates? Not when you have an alternative where you can just sit around the south of Africa. Sure, it's more time. Sure, it's more freight. I'll just pass it on to the customer. I don't care.
True.
Now, the problem is, as bad as that is, there's an alternate. You start talking about the Persian Gulf. You start talking about Iran. You remember back during the Gulf War how the world was talking about oil shipments and how Iraq was going to be able to impede the shipments and attack ships and all this other kind of stuff. Go look at a map and go see how little shore Iraq actually has on the Persian Gulf.
Iran's
and
got
then
a
look
big
at
one.
Iran.
Iran's got a big one.
Oh my gosh. All these countries that we never think about.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And then, you know, just take all those Arab Gulf countries. That's probably what half of the urea market in the world, or the exports that feed half of our exports coming out of that region right there. It's very critical to the American corn producer.
Yeah, it's about 52% of the global export market. And just to your point, one out of every 2 tons of urea that is exported around the world comes from North Africa, Middle East. So, yeah, it's unfortunately we are dependent on imports to meet our nitrogen demand. And we will continue to be for a while, because you look at the Canadian government, they have not been exactly jumping up and down for producing more fertilizer using old technology. Same thing here in the States. And even if we did, you're still talking multi-years before those things churn out the first ton.
Well, when you talk about, so we need to import a lot of urea into this country. That seems pretty easy. Let's just buy it. And how do the prices? So we bring everything in for the most part through New Orleans, NOLA. So basically, with these prices that we think are too high, how's that compare, you know, our NOLA price compared to the rest of the world?
We're cheap. And I use cheap with quotation marks, right? But we are cheap. When you start to look at, again, we'll use Middle Eastern values, and that's going to be put to the test here tomorrow. India is going to try and purchase about 1.5 million tons. So we're going to find out very quickly what the price idea is around the world. But when you use kind of what's being discussed out there about a 550 Arab Gulf, when you take 550, you put your vessel freight on it, convert short ton, you have to put through to put it on the vessel or barges here in the Gulf. You're talking about the same price, 550, or I'm sorry, 350. You start to look at where our current barges are. We're about $25 a ton under that. Now, one of the things people will sit there and say, well, if we're such a discount, why are we bringing anything in? We're importing stuff. We're fine. And that's right. But there are a lot of contractual tons that come to the States, regardless of what the price difference is. They want that outflow. They want to know where those tons are going. They're willing to sell it at a discount to know, I've got this many tons going in January. I've got this many tons in February. I've got this many tons August, September, October, all the way through the year. But there are additional tons over the top of those that we need to call on. So as we start getting to January, February, and this is kind of a little bit of my fear, is that if we continue to see first half of the fertilizer year, we've not imported much of anything versus what we need. Now we need to start calling on those tons. Well, how do you do that?
Raise the price.
You either got to get level money or higher money than the rest of the world to really incentivize that flow to start. That's all of a sudden people are asking, well, what's your upside? I was like, I can easily walk into double digits. I can easily talk a $50 plus increase just moving us from a discount to a slight premium versus the world.
So Josh, just for me, so basically the tons we're getting are already contracted, just so exporters can know, right? They've got to know that these, and so we're buying them immediately. We're paying less than the rest of the global market. And whenever you go back, we don't get all of the tons we need through those contract arrangements. And whenever you all and others go back in to buy the remaining, what we know we're going to need as we get better numbers and better an idea of what, how many acres we're going to have, those will be at the global market rate. As demand continues to increase around the globe, it's probably going to keep pace or maybe outpace production. So this is the way our world is anyway now, right? I mean, it's nothing to change that.
Yeah. Now you can talk a storyline like, well, what if China all of a sudden starts exporting heavily back to normal levels? I'm not going to say it's not possible. It doesn't look feasible, but something we do need to consider. Anytime you think you know what they're going to do, it'll be the exact opposite. So we keep that in the back of our mind. You know, we talked about the lack of exports there. We didn't talk about Europe. Europe is still struggling with really high natural gas prices. Their cheapest gas supply came from Russia. Well, they got into it regarding Ukraine. Those flows stopped. Somebody blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. They're paying double-digit natural gas values. That does not work for their nitrogen production. So that's about probably about 3 million ton of production that's offline that they have to go buy from the rest of the world. I mean, very quickly, you're talking about 8 million ton of supply that's missing from the global market that would normally be there. And that's the thing. We're continuing to just wait and wait and wait. And right now we feel okay. It's 2024. Spring seems like it's a lifetime. We got all the winter ahead of us. Mark my words, January 2nd, the market will come back. They're going to look at the calendar and they're going to say, holy crap, it's 2025. Middle of March is 2.5 months away. It takes 30 days to get a vessel of urea from the Middle East to the U.S. shores. It takes another 30 days to get that product into a retailer's warehouse and ready for the farmer. If I buy a ton right now, we're talking early March.
Yeah, that's 60 days total, and that's if everything works right. That's if we don't have to send ships around the Horn of Africa. I mean, you know, it's that's if everything is working like a well-oiled machine, and then and we know that stuff happens and those dates slip. And so it's we used to talk about by the middle of February, if you're buying something, it better be on its way. Mm-hmm. So it's a real situation that we're in, you know. And I think one of the things, and this is a credit to all the ag retailers out there and all the distribution companies. We've never really run the American farmer short on anything. We've had some scares. We've seen some tightness. We've seen some products go up, but we've never not been able to get it. And there's things that we do behind the scenes sometimes that don't make financial sense, but we make sure that the farmer never sees us run out. And that's the one thing we talk about every spring. And we're worried about that day when it comes and it says, hey, we're out. We're waiting on this vessel to arrive.
Well, and I've probably said this on past episodes with you guys. The distribution system, it's like a duck swimming across the water. And to the most part, the farmer is looking from above the water. And what do you see when you see a duck, move from one point to another? Just glides.
Yeah.
Effortlessly. Barely awake. You barely see it. My gosh, she's not even doing anything. You dip your head underneath the water and that duck is kicking like hell trying to get over there. And that's what the market is always to me. Because to your point, we've never had real outages. Yeah, we've had periods where maybe you got to wait a little bit. And maybe you see prices move up if the retailer doesn't eat that. But underneath the surface, all of these things are happening, trying to make that work. And you think about, to your point, Jeff, the global vessel shipment situation. What if it has to go south? Well, that's another, week and a half, 2 weeks. Yeah. What if the river situation pops up again? We've been dealing with low water, high water, all this stuff. We're in a decent spot right now, but you're never that far away from that being a story again. So I never say this saying, oh my gosh, we're in trouble. Oh, you better go buy every single ton. This isn't a scare tactic. And in fact, when you think about it, the first half of the fertilizer year, the July through December, it's not a big import period for us. But as we start moving into January, February, March, we got to get off the pot. It's time to move. We got to get stuff moving. And that's where we start to talk about, hey, we get into Q1, the calendar says 25. It's a mental shift. And there's these mental shifts throughout the marketplace. Spring runs, honestly, until July 4th. You come back July 5th, it's summertime. Harvest gets done, it's fall season. January 1st, we got to get ready for spring. I mean, there's these weird little shifts where you know it's coming, but there's still some mentally that when you pass that point, it just fundamentally changes the way you look at the market. At least it does for me.
No, I would agree with that. That's, people ask me sometimes, what do you do buying fertilizer? I say, I'm always looking 6 months out. It's just when we're in the middle of busy season, that's great. That to me, that deal's done. We're moving on to the next season. So it's, you always got to be looking ahead. So we talked about urea and stuff. Let's talk about, switch over to UAN. We had some summer fill values came out, corn prices were down. It just didn't feel good to us. It's like, boy, that's a little higher than what we thought it should have came out at. And a lot of people sat on the sidelines. What's that market look like today?
Unfortunately, snug like urea is. And again, let's look at it from a global perspective. Now, UAN is one, when we look at it, it is you could almost consider it a specialty market when you consider it against the size of things like anhydrous and urea. It's a small market with very few destinations around the world. And why is it not used as much? You've got to be a very technological, advanced agricultural market to use it. It's easy to move dry. You put it in some bags, you throw it on the cart, and your freaking mule can carry it to your farm. Liquid is hard, jugs and tanks and stuff like this. And then the equipment to put it on. Again, why do we see pictures of people throwing the urea out by hand? because you can do it. Do you see people dipping their hand in a bucket of UAN and flicking it on a corn plant? No. So it's just one of those. It's not that many decimates around the world. So when we have production hiccups, it's felt more. And we've seen some production hiccups from, Trinidad, right? They've had some natural gas tightness situations. European production, 75% of normal because of the high natural gas costs. That's about 2 million tons missing in the global marketplace. Here in North America, we've not had a major production outage. But when you go around and you see all these minor ones and you start to add up the numbers, it's a few hundred thousand ton of production that isn't there anymore. And we can't make that up. So you've got a little bit of a tight supply situation going on with UAN. It's nothing crazy. Again, we're not saying, oh, you're not going to get it. You better rush and buy it right now. But it has made the S&D snug. And we have to worry about a little bit about what's going to happen here in later January when Trump takes office. One of our biggest import flows of UAN is coming from Russia. Now, the hope is that Trump and Putin seem to have a respectable relationship, that they can find common ground. Maybe this war situation will go away and everything will get back to normal. What if it doesn't? What if egos start playing out there? And Trump likes tariffs. And he could just sit there and say, okay, fine. You're not going to get out of Ukraine. You're not going to find common ground. You're not going to find peace. 25% duty against you. Well, guess what? North American manufacturer has now removed one of the biggest competitors that we have for North America.
That's it's a scary reality that we've got to deal with. One thing, I'm jumping gears a little bit. You talk about duties, and we've seen what duties have done in our phosphate market. So can we switch gears and jump over to phosphate and talk about those same duties and where that situation's at? And then, that was a 5-year duty when it was put on the front side. But I also hear guys saying, once a duty gets on, it's hard to get it to come off. Can you speak to mm-hmm. that?
Yeah, it'd be probably a good idea to go back and say, like, when they came on, what it was, why, how they happened in the first place, and then what they are today. Because that's been a while.
Right, it was 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Election yep. year.
So yeah, let's, and just in case anybody's new to the audience, right? In the case they don't know the story. If you go back to summer of 2020, historically low phosphate prices. And in fact, the price was so low, Mosaic, who is our biggest manufacturer of phosphate here in the States, was having to curtail production because the cost of the market was lower than their cost of production. They were losing money. So they needed to shut it down. I don't blame them one bit. People kind of get hacked off and stuff. Oh, they ought to produce. No, they should not. If you're at a loss, that's not what they're in the business for. And when they looked at some of these big importers who were taking that market share, it was a bit of an unfair market. When you look at Morocco, their environmental standards are not the same as what Mosaic has to be held up to. And when you look at some of the Russian produced tons, there's different markets in Russia. We'll leave it at that. I don't want to get a hit on them here or something. So, but it was a bit of an unfair market. So what Mosaic did is just that they said, we're not going to survive as this is. We need some protection if we're going to be held to this higher standard. So they went to the government for countervailing duties to be placed against Moroccan and Russian imports. And they won that case. And those duties remain in place today, even after all the challenges and the relooks at it and reviews and everything else. These are still in place. And those are in addition to Trump having put duties on Chinese phosphate imports. So again, the phosphate market, it's a big global market, right? But when you break it down, the top 5 countries in the world that export control about, 85, 90% of the global production and exports? Well, that list comprises of Russia, dutied. Morocco, dutied. China, dutied. U.S., well, that's us. And the fifth one is Saudi Arabia. And there was in the past a partnership between Mosaic and MODN, the Saudi Arabia facility that produces phosphate. So suddenly, we've cut out 3 of the 5 biggest producers in the world, and we're 1 of the 5.
Yeah, that's been a tough pill to swallow. What are those duty rates today? I know we were coming into fall. They had a kind of an update hearing. I think Mosaic came to the table and said, hey, we're good. We're not asking for anything else. But the duties went up anyway. Can you speak to that at all?
I believe Morocco's is around 15%. It's like 14.78 or something small like that. But let's just call it 15 for nice round numbers. Russia range thing from like 18 to well over 20%, depending on which company it is. And I believe the Chinese duties are sitting at 25% still. And here's the problem. A politician will look at duties and tariffs and things like this and think, ah, we're really going to stick it to them. And if it's an oversupplied market where they have to have our demand to move their product, that is absolutely right. They will be the one that pays it. They will have to be the one that has to lower their FOB price in order to compete in our market. Phosphate globally is not oversupplied. Again, we need to talk about China. China, historically speaking, is the world's largest supplier of DAPMAP. 2021, they exported about 10 million tons. This year through October, 5.7.
So they cut it
looking
half.
Like they're going to draw down those exports before they ramp back up again. In fact, there's a little bit of fear on our side. They had committed about a million ton of sales to Ethiopia for Q1 ship. We're not sure if they're going to honor it right now.
Oh, my. So, then those tons will be look. Then they'll be looking for those. Oh, my gosh.
Lots of ripple
effects. Here's the thing. Yeah, and that's the deal. A lot of people like to sit there and say, well, we're this sky high of a phosphate price only because of those duties. Unfortunately, and I don't like saying this, because I don't like going into it and saying that's the wrong way of looking at it. But when you look at our FOB price, and again, I'm using NOLA DAP, and you look at the other two biggest buyers in the world, who is India and Brazil, we are the exact same FOB price. We are not a massive premium to the world. We are actually right in line with where we ought to be as far as an importing country is.
But to attract more tons to this country, we have to be higher.
Yeah. And that's, it does bring in the question when it comes to phosphate. Where are you going to find those excess tons from? You have access to Saudi Arabia material. But boy, that list falls off really, really fast. I mean, when you start going beyond that, you start talking about places like Australia. But they only export a few hundred thousand ton, and Jordan and these different small countries. You have to go to a lot of small exporters around the world to try and build somewhat of a decent number. And again, you're trying to do that in a very short window. There's still a lot of the Midwest that's running applications right now. We ended the fall fairly empty. We have about 2.5-3 months before we ramp the sucker back up again.
True. That is true. It's coming quick.
Yeah.
So Josh, you know, as a buyer for an ag retailer, today, if, I guess, as you look around the different products, of all the MPKs, what keeps you up at night? You know, what, where would Josh Linville be spending most of his time right now trying to shore up and make sure he had covered? And I think nitrogen. We talked about from an ag retail standpoint, but that's going to, mm-hmm. that's going to roll down to the farmer where he needs to look at his prepaid dollars.
Easily nitrogen. Because it's a product we have to have, right? You can have the case of like, hey, if we've kept our phosphate soil levels high enough, you could probably skip a year, reduce a year, and we'll be okay. There's going to be some residual there. It's going to be the same thing for potash. But nitrogen, we have to have it. There's a direct correlation. If you reduce nitrogen here, you yield goes down by X. And there are some situations out there. Look, I don't like counting on these sensational, oh, the Middle East is going to erupt, or Russian tons are going to cease to exist, or any of these kind of things. Just, it's such a low probability situation. And you think about what the impact is. It's enormous. It's huge. It's massive. So nitrogen, just because of the need of it, there is no skipping nitrogen. You better put that on the field, or you got to have a conversation of what's my expectation come, you know, September, October.
That's true. That's true. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is potash. You know, potash seems to be probably one of the more stable products. Prices have come down over the last couple of years, and it seems to be kind of, you know, leveling off and just trade in a very narrow range. What's the outlook on the potash side of things?
Our view is it stays steady with a slight bearish tint to it. I see potash being very well supplied, and there's more production coming online. You know, there's new plant coming online in Canada here in the coming years. You still got Belarus, who was landlocked and got shut out from the world when they allowed Russia to use their ground to invade Kiev from the north. They're rebuilding and getting new supply routes out to the rest of the world. So they're returning. Russia's supposed to be ramping up production. China's been investing very heavily in Laos. They want to obviously get production from nearby. Not only does it lower their dependence on Western countries, but it also increases their sphere of influence around them. So we continue to see potash being very well supplied. And I think there's a conversation of, is it oversupplied in the next 2 to 3 years? I don't see demand keeping up with the amount of production coming. Yeah. So that what that means is it should keep a lid on price ideas. I know there has been some recent discussions, articles about manufacturers saying, well, we think this, this, and this. I just don't see it. Listen, they're doing their job. I don't blame them. I just kind of disagree with some of the fundamentals they're looking at.
You know, I think Belarus came out and said that they needed to cut production. But at the same time, I felt like Belarus was saying, I think you guys need to cut production. We'll stay where we're at.
Yeah. Everybody needs to cut production.
You notice everybody stayed really quiet after that statement. Everybody's like, yeah, you do what you got to do. We're going to keep churning this out. We're fine.
Yeah, those communist countries are all about communism until they're selling something. Then they got to figure it out.
Oh, yeah. That's
the only thing that I would say spooks me from a short-term situation is, again, the Trump threats of tariffs against Canada. That could be an interesting situation if he takes office and they haven't found common ground, just because so much potash flows down us. And again, that's something people, I had a few people online challenge me and say, oh, it's fine. We have enough production in the U.S. that we don't need them. I'm like, that's not even remotely close to true. It's no, we have to have the import stop.
I thought Canada was going to be our 51st state.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. And we'll get this episode flagged.
Are they always talk about the blue walls and the red wall. Are they going to be the white wall?
Yeah. We're going to get flagged just for having Josh on anyway. Oh, so that's
a good time.
No, that's it's all good. Another question I've gotten from some growers, and you know, they hear things, they read stuff on the internet, they follow you on X, and which is, everybody needs to get on X and follow Josh and get his insight. But, you know, we see some of these higher prices and stuff, but then they hear that, hey, you know, a U.S. company is exporting urea, they're exporting UAN, they're exporting, you know, phosphates. Well, how can we have high prices? Don't they have to keep that here for us in the U.S.?
Not even a little bit. And that's a problem. And this is really prevalent when you think about UAN. Actually, nitrogen in general. Europe, like we said, their production rates are about 75% of normal because they've lost that gas flow from Russia. Their cost of production is just simply too high for that 25% that's offline right now. That has been a boon for U.S. manufacturers of nitrogen because all of a sudden, they can sit there and say, well, here's my price to you guys in North America. Well, that's too high. Okay, fine. I'll export it. Phosphate, we have import duties. There is not a single export duty that I know of. There is nothing stopping them from exporting. Now, I'm not saying that to try and attack them, because when you do look at the exports, I remove Mexico, I remove Canada. Those aren't considered exports in my book, or North America, we're one big happy family. Happy family. but the export flow has really, really subsided since these import duties have put in place. So, but the ability is still there. If we were to start getting a little heavier supply, they can export. So that's the problem with these things is, and I really say this on phosphate, I understand why the import duties were put in place. I disagree with them in today's market because it's just fundamentally different from what it was. But I just wish when they looked at stuff like this, where it's a commodity like a phosphate, if they're going to put in an import duty, I wish they'd do the same thing for an export duty. And sit there and say, listen, this will not include Canada. This will not include Mexico. But anything outside of those two countries are not allowed to go to the rest of the world.
You keep product but home.
That's logical thinking. That doesn't work in D.C. We know this.
Yeah. What are you thinking?
So we heard it here. Josh says government programs need to be logical. So.
All right. Well, thank you guys. Ran the gamut on the products.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there anything else out there that you find interesting that we need to be watching or just being aware of?
The biggest thing is, like you said, you try to talk to everybody. Keep your eyes on the world. It has so much more of an impact. That's not to say that, obviously, what happens here as we get closer to the spring, we will become more of an island. It will matter more about what we have in place because we simply ran out of time to get what we needed coming in, which is what we have is what we have. but these times of years, you got to be more focused on the world. The biggest thing I've been trying to tell people, and listen, I'm in no place to tell anybody what to do, right? These guys are worth so much more money than I could ever dream of. I can't buy green paint unless it's on my freaking lawnmower. But the biggest thing I've been trying to tell folks is look for your opportunities. Right now, it's a very tough time. 2025 forecast for farmer economics is not good. Grain prices aren't good. Inputs are high. It's a struggle, especially coming out of what we just dealt with here in 21, 22, 23. It was a good time.
Sure.
Do not let the emotion of how poor it looks as we go into 2025 run your decision-making process. I will tell you right now, we can get my wife on the here. We can get Angela on the phone, and she can share with you all the stupid, angry decisions I've made, all the emotional decisions I've made. To a T, she will tell you about how each one of them was the dumbest decision I've ever made. That's emotion, right? We're all subject to it. And there's nothing wrong with looking at it and being mad and saying, why do I kill myself, you know, doing all this stuff, staying up in the middle of the night, you know, trying to fix all this stuff, beating the heck out of myself, and then being subject to Mother Nature, who might not even give me a crop at the end of the year just to go sell it for a loss. It's okay to be angry about it. But when it comes time for marketing, this is buying, this is selling. Let the numbers talk. And frankly speaking, if you see an opportunity, it's like, hey, I can lock this in and that's profitable for me. That makes sense. Don't let that emotion have you drag your feet. I'm like, well, if it's a little bit more, oh, I could get a little bit. I don't want to do that. What if it gets even better? Listen, I'll tell you what. And I tell these people in presentation stuff all the time. I'm like, if you listen to me and you buy your fertilizer because you listen to me and you actually sold some grain against it, and that was a profitable piece of business for you, and you get to next December and you say, that was my worst decision, you can yell at me all day. And then we'll raise a toast to a one heck of a good year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably pretty good advice is to, you know, to try to take the emotion out of those marketing decisions and stuff. And that's probably a pretty good place to wrap it up. So, Josh, as always, we appreciate you coming on and sharing some insight with us and giving us those global updates, as I think that has a big impact on us.
That's very valuable.
Yeah. Absolutely, yes.
Thanks a lot, Josh. And I'll keep my eye out for an old Honda.
Honda Prelude.
Prelude, specifically.
Yeah. Prelude. It's got to have the Spark-O-Matic radio
Spark-O-Matic. In it. That's a unicorn. I don't know if we'll see one, but we'll keep an eye out. Thank you, Josh. We really appreciate it.
All right.
Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks,
guys.
Josh.
We'll see you. Bye.